Chapter 3. Technologies of the Office. Back in the early 1990s, the Japanese steel company Nippon decided to get into the computing market. Instead of developing a desktop model to compete with the industry giants IBM and Apple, it opted to compete in the newly established laptop market. The dimensions of the Librex 386 SX notebook were about the same as a laptop today, but it was 2 inches thick. It weighed 6.5 pounds. Like a lot of laptops during this time, its screen was a bit wonky. It boasted 16 shades of gray, but you never quite knew what the screen was going to do when you opened it. Its list price? $3,299. Just over $6,100 in 2020 dollars. Who could spend that much on a personal computer? Most families were buying desktops to be shared by the household, so the laptop was marketed straight at the coveted business market. In one Librex ad, a 40-something-year-old sits in an Adirondack chair, in Dockers, a t-shirt, and a ball cap. The outline of a mountain hovers in the sun-setting distance. In his right hand, he holds a hulking cell phone. And then, balanced on the left of his chair, there's that cinder blocks of a Librex. It didn't matter that the battery lasted just 90 minutes, or that it then took a full 5 hours to recharge. The business dad of the future was ready to get to work. At that point, working from home, then referred to as telecommuting, had been on the rise for more than a decade. In 1975, a full third of the 2.6 million people considered working from home were farmers. By 1994, an estimated 7 million Americans were telecommuting, and companies like Hewlett-Packard employed an alternative work options manager. PC Magazine reported that 50% of prospective telecommuters had already purchased their own PCs or planned to buy modems and software to facilitate the transition. But the slow spread of the home computer began to change things, at least for those with the funds to sit in the first-class cabin of an airplane, which is where a 1990s ad for the Kodak Dynex envisioned the user of its mobile printer. The sight of a passenger hunched over in an airplane seat pecking away at a computer no longer draws stares, the editor of PC Magazine wrote in the introduction of an issue dedicated to laptops, which included a fold-out Road Warrior's guide, complete with the phone numbers in major cities to dial to connect to CompuServe, aka the internet, and basic instructions for logging on to the bulletin board system and email services. These workers could transition from the office to home, from home to the hotel, on a business meeting. But, as we discussed in the previous chapters, this sort of flex has a dark side. The ability to take your work anywhere means the ability for work to infiltrate all corners of your life, including those, like the wilderness, that previously repelled it. The Librex ad with the Adirondacks chair looks quite a bit different when you look at it through this lens. Business Dad isn't liberated from the office. He's trapped by it. He just happens to be out in nature. This is what happened to us when we moved to Montana. When the time we used to spend commuting into Manhattan, which we thought we'd allocate to hikes and kayaking and cross-country skiing, was simply absorbed by more work. And if you're listening to this book, chances are you're living in the paradox of Business Dad, stuck in a technological purgatory, caught between its utopian promises and its dystopian perils. Every one of us now keeps a tiny supercomputer in our pockets that would make the Librex's hard drive melt with jealousy. We can pull the internet down from the sky in even the most remote location. Work can find us in every moment. On the subway, on the chairlift, on the running trail, in the bathroom. It is a golden era of connectivity, and by extension, efficiency. By constructing elegant solutions to enduring annoyances, say, an app that monitors traffic patterns to get you to the quickest route home, or a program that finally tames the jungle of your inbox, our devices purport to chip away at the messy inefficiencies of everyday life. Increased efficiency means more of the most precious commodity, time. But time for what exactly? Usually, to do more work. Despite the miraculous technological affordances in our life, few of them have liberated us as advertised, and nowhere is that truer than our working lives. Where today's office tech has absorbed all the formalities, anxieties, and oppressive mundanity of our corporate life and ported them into every corner of our lives. The magical ability to see your coworkers face-to-face from anywhere in the world morphs into Zoom fatigue. The lively collaborative instant messaging app gives way to an always-on surveillance tool that lives on the company's servers forever. Our shared digital calendar evolves into a way for others to demand our time and attention until there's none left for ourselves. The more efficient we become, the more overwhelmed we feel. This paradox is not new. For as long as people have been laboring, new technologies have promised to streamline how and where work gets done. Some are implemented with best intentions. Others have been cruelly or cynically applied. But almost all have unintended consequences, even when they're not digital. From the open office plan to the Aeron chair, new ideas about the physical design of the office have reshaped not only our work environment, but also our relationship to work. Innovations that were supposed to make the office more humane got co-opted, put through cost efficiency calculators, and end up making the workplace feel even more like an over-designed cage. Part of the problem is the obsession with thrift. The best, most inclusive design costs money and time, resources that many companies are hesitant to part with. But even the sprawling, no-expenses-spared campuses of Silicon Valley share a fundamental flaw with the mundane, fluorescent-lit cubicle. With a few utopian exceptions, all of these designs have been oriented towards efficiency and productivity. Not in the service of less work, but in the hopes of fostering a life enveloped by it. In truth, office technology, and the cult of efficiency, in which it is breathlessly adopted, have never been about getting all of our work done in less time. At least, not since the dreaming days of the early 20th century, when economic theorists and labor advocates saw technology as a way to finally achieve the 30-hour, 20-hour, and even 10-hour workweek. That dream was devoured long ago. Instead, the ever-accelerating goal of office tech and design has been to clear space in someone's life, then immediately seed it with the potential for more productivity. This is why our current moment feels so full of possibility and so incredibly treacherous. We're in an efficiency purgatory, caught between all the liberating and oppressive effects of office tech and design. Even from the stifling gloom of the pandemic, we could see the faint outline of a future that makes good on office technology's grand promise. To actually free us, not only from the commute or the tyranny of the open office plan, but from the creep of work into every inch of our personal lives. It's an alluring vision. What if our tools could actually, legitimately make us work less? And what if the time we regained from stamping out inefficiencies was truly ours? Office technology and design are not essentially evil. But we have to commit to using those tools to add dimensionality to our lives, instead of further flattening them for the ease of our jobs. In order to realize that vision, we need to understand all the ways that tech and design have successfully beguiled us in the past. We have to know how to spot when a flashy technology, a gorgeous office setup, or a new way of communicating is actually just an invitation for more work in new camouflage. We must begin to see productivity and efficiency as a means to an actual end, not a means to more work. The stakes of this moment are high. If we aren't vigilant, we risk squandering this opportunity for a genuine shift in the way we orient ourselves to work, and the tools that facilitate remote work will become even more robust apparatuses of surveillance and control. As with the tech and design shifts of the past, the degradation of these tools won't be readily apparent. There will be no cackling executive rubbing their hands together greedily behind closed doors. It'll just feel like our brightest hopes fading to the slow grind of one long, endless Wednesday. We aren't doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past, but if we do, we may very well be unable to reverse them. The final, flimsy barrier between our personal lives and our work lives, already buckling under the pressure, will come crashing down. All the worst, mind-numbing parts of working from home during the pandemic will be our everyday reality. If that sounds like hell, it's time to arm yourself against it, with the knowledge of how we corrupted the tech and design of the past, and an actual plan for how to avoid them moving forward. In 1981, while working on a book about the future of work, a young Harvard business professor named Shoshana Zuboff visited an old pulp mill. The mill's bleach plant had recently been redesigned and outfitted with a state-of-the-art technology, including digital sensors and monitors that fed signals to a shiny new centralized control room stocked with computers whirring away on brand new microprocessors. To an outsider, it was all very impressive. But, as Zuboff quickly learned, the workers despised it. Their primary object of scorn were the doors. In order to keep the considerable heat and potentially noxious fumes of the bleaching room from entering the control room, the factory had installed an airlocking system. Push a button, step in, and the sliding glass door closes behind you. The next set of doors won't open till the other is shut. The new doors offered an added layer of safety, but for the workers, the extra steps were tedious and frustrating. For years, they had been able to move from room to room as they pleased, so they took matters into their own hands. Every day, they plowed through the corridor and wedged their hands through a rubber seal that ran down the center of the door. With the mighty heft of their shoulders, they brute-forced the door open. The door eventually just stopped sealing. For Zuboff, the worker's reaction was a living metaphor of worker ambivalence towards automation. They want to be protected from toxic fumes, she wrote in her 1988 book, In the Age of the Smart Machine, but they simultaneously feel a stubborn rebellion against a structure that no longer requires either the strength or the know-how lodged in their bodies. What Zuboff observed wasn't just the casual frustration of a few blue-collar workers, but a defining anxiety amid an age of massive technological change. The nature of work was undergoing a fundamental reorganization. Suddenly, things that had been resistant or impossible to measure became quantifiable, analyzable, transformed into streams of data and reports. Armed with that data, businesses could see for the first time what they were wasting, opportunities for more efficiency, and how employees were actually allocating their time. In theory, all this new data might have made a worker's job better. Hands-on activities like mixing chemicals or manually cranking valves in a pulp plant are physically taxing. Doing them from the safety of a control room would be easier for everyone. But automation had the unforeseen consequence of turning their jobs from something tangible, with rhythms of touch and feel, into an abstraction. Or, as Zuboff put it, it felt like being yanked away from a world that could be known because it could be sensed. Technology robbed workers of what had been highly valued physical knowledge about a job. They knew the precise way to unstick a gear, how a finicky gauge always reads 5 degrees higher than it is, or the sound a machine makes when something's about to break. That knowledge, accumulated over years on the job, had served as leverage over management. If the company refused to come to an agreement with their union, it would take the company weeks, if not years, to find workers with the skills to replace them. The threat of a strike had real power, because workers' knowledge was precious. Sensors and computers took the craft behind that work, quantified it, and automated it, a process often referred to as de-skilling. The workers' knowledge was made obsolete. At the same time, managers were newly vested with quantitative authority over their employees' work lives. They held the data and the ability to wield it in accordance with their desires, which meant they also held the power. In this way, technological innovation wrested the most valuable elements of workers' lives away from them and handed them straight to management. No wonder they resented it. Of course, executives and big business reframed the story quite differently. These tools were not just ways to juice productivity and profits, they were also good for the worker. Less manual labor meant less strenuous and often less dangerous labor. For some workers, doing back-breaking work in mills or smelting plants, it was a genuine reprieve. But it also introduced new problems. A skilled machinist talking to the MIT researcher Harley Shaken in 1985 said the experience of operating a computerized machine tool made him feel like a, quote, rat in a cage. Another worker, tasked with operating a robotic welding system, said, "You don't have time to light a cigarette. I'd take my old job hand welding any day." A third employee, forced to monitor a numerical control, or an NC system, said, "I'm a worker, not a sitter. I like to be kept busy. My day goes by faster. My mind is more active. You get a little weak-minded on the NC." Automated work, Shaken found, was not always more efficient, nor was it necessarily more reliable. But it was sold to workers as the only route forward. When General Electric began modernizing a dishwasher factory in the early 1980s, adding an electronic nervous system that oversaw a complex maze of robots and 24 computer lieutenants at critical points on the factory floor, they met with union reps, foremen, and other workers to communicate the same argument. Modernize, or we'll all be out of a job. Companies are not going to survive in the marketplace without this kind of equipment, a senior VP at GE told the New York Times. The future demands it. Across the manufacturing industry, automation was treated as a sort of magic bullet, a means of gaining back the ground American companies had lost to the global market in general, and Japan in particular. Automation would increase productivity, and productivity would provide the solution to all American woes. The idea extended to the office, which, over the course of the 20th century, had come to be understood as its own form of factory, just one that produces paper and moves it around from desk to desk. Back in 1925, William Henry Leffingwell, a disciple of the Frederick Taylor School of Optimization, had drafted plans for the straight-line flow of work. He redesigned the office into a sort of paper assembly line, so workers could move documents without the necessity of the clerk even rising from his seat. The overarching principle was this. Every time a clerk left his seat, he lost precious seconds of productivity. But these Taylorist reforms of the office were met with the same resistance as in the factory. Workers hated them. Other efficiency efforts were easier to sell, especially those cloaked in the language of technological advancement. Elevators, fluorescent lighting, movable walls, and air conditioning, popularized over the course of the 20th century, were all means of upping productivity. Same for the open office, which was first proposed by a pair of German brothers, Eberhard and Wolfgang Schnell, in 1958. In place of rows of desks and corner offices, the Schnells saw dynamic clusters and movable partitions, an office landscape, or a Bürolandschaft. When the idea for a Bürolandschaft was first introduced, it felt scandalous. The same way, say, working from home would later feel in the early 1980s. When the renowned interior designer John F. Pyle first encountered the plans in the pages of an esteemed architectural journal, he described finding them so shocking in character as to make me assume that I was in the presence of some British joke. But Bürolandschaft was designed to deal with an organization problem endemic to German offices. Staff were arranged in totally illogical ways, crammed into rooms with people in different departments, all doing different types of tasks. Employees would distract each other, compete with each other for no reason, and when they needed to meet with other people on their team, they'd be forced to go to another floor or even another building. In such a setting, Pyle wrote, needed communication becomes slow and cumbersome. Competition and rivalry thrive, and all the kinds of wastefulness and stupidity one associates with bureaucracy become commonplace. The setup of the Bürolandschaft was designed to follow the natural lines of communication, decrease inefficiencies, and, as an added bonus, cost less. No real hierarchies meant no expensively furnished offices for management. One huge room was far easier to heat, cool, light, and electrify. Yet the design, however, well-meaning in theory, was a disaster in practice. Many companies embraced the cost-shaving elements for the gang employee spaces, which were loud and antagonistic to anything approximating concentration or privacy, but balked at actually eliminating offices for higher-ups. They were desperate to decrease costs, but they were also fiercely protective of the status quo. In Germany, Scandinavia, and the Netherlands, the experience of working in an open office design was so miserable that in the 1970s, local worker councils effectively mandated their removal. But not in the United States, where, as the architecture critic James S. Russell notes, Americans characteristically reworked the plan into something cheaper and more ordered. The curvilinear informality of the Schnells' design was formalized into workstations with shelves, cabinets, and dividing panels, what would eventually devolve into the cubicle. The development, like so many in American history, was facilitated by the tax code. The Revenue Act, passed in 1962, allowed for a 7% tax credit on property with a useful life of 8 years. You couldn't deduct the cost of a fixed wall, but a partition? Go for it. A cubicle offered the illusion of privacy, but with little of the reality. You could still hear the conversations of your neighbors, managers still have access to a full view of your current work, you were still hundreds of feet from the nearest window or source of natural light. But these offices weren't built to make employees' experience of work better or more bearable. They were meant to match the demands of the flexible organization, poised to expand and contract, and to meet market demands, shedding and accumulating employees as needed. For Frank Duffy, the author of one of the first books to introduce office landscaping to the United Kingdom, the felted gray cubicle represented the equal distribution of misery, within which anyone and everyone can be replaced in any order and at any time. The cubicle costs so little, bears so few traces of its occupant, and is so easy to dismantle. The perfect structure for an economic mindset and an attitude towards labor in which the workforce was increasingly figured as disposable. The open office was celebrated and implemented with a mind toward worker efficiency, as a means of facilitating communication and undamming the flows of information, decreasing conflict and competition in the office. As Nikhil Saval points out in Cubed, even the bastardized American version did make some forms of communication easier. You could still talk, after all, even with the sounds of the office in the background. But in so doing, it made concentration and contemplation nearly impossible. In the rush to open plan the world in the 1970s and 80s, Saval writes, some crucial values for the performance of work were lost, including, somewhat ironically, the very efficiency and productivity that these designs were intended to create. A 1985 study of offices found that levels of privacy were a primary predictor of job satisfaction and job performance. Designing with a mind towards efficiency, in other words, produced increasingly inefficient workers. When you implement a new office design with an eye only to what it facilitates and not what is lost, you will simply create a new set of problems. Same for short-term strategies to cut tax burdens or real estate footprints. If a technology promises to cut costs quickly and significantly, chances are high that there will be perhaps as yet imperceptible effects of those cuts, and they will be absorbed by your already overburdened workforce. New office technologies, including the spaces where we expect employees to work and that determine how they interact with people while doing that work, are never simply good or bad, but their effects have never been and never will be neutral. When it comes to the ideals of productivity, office design could promise to do only so much. The most skilled typists, even in the most scientifically arranged office, could type only so many words per minute. As the day went on, precision levels went down, and it took longer and longer to type an error-free document. But the word processor, coupled with the Xerox machine, the dictaphone, and the office printer, promised to liberate efficiency goals from human limitations. Across the office world, workers were promised that these new technologies would make their lives easier. And yes, it was great not to have to type the same letter in triplicate. But many of the machines were situated in spaces that simply weren't designed for them. Mimeographs in rooms without ventilation, word processors in spaces without proper lighting. Thousands of workers reported migraines, severe eye strain, cataracts, bronchitis, and allergies. Automation was literally making office workers sick. But they were also mentally miserable. Shoshana Zuboff spent hours interviewing workers in industrial settings for In the Age of the Smart Machine, but she also spent significant time with clerical workers. Like their blue-collar counterparts, the people she interviewed were adrift as the result of fast technological changes of their jobs. Dentist office employees and insurance claims workers both saw their jobs, which were once social in nature, turn into glorified data entry positions. Cubicles visually walled them off from their colleagues, turning coworkers into an annoying buzz of wafting voices and telephone rings and keyboard clacks. As the job increasingly tethered them to their desks, they became more estranged from their managers, who in turn began to view them as drones. "We used to be able to see each other and talk," one insurance claims representative told Zuboff. "Sure, sometimes we just talked about what we were going to make for dinner. But we always worked while we talked." Another representative described the feeling of losing touch with the outside world. "The only reality we have left is when we get to talk to a customer." Indeed, the most striking part of her reporting comes when Zuboff asked the workers to draw themselves in their new jobs. The illustrations were grim and childlike. Chained to desks, surrounded by bottles of aspirin, dressed in prison stripes, outfitted with blinders, closely observed by their supervisors, surrounded by walls, enclosed without sunlight or food, bleary-eyed with fatigue, solitary, frowning. But as was the case on the factory floor, few people listened to the people tasked with actually using the technology. Leaders often attributed worker reticence to initial fears of losing their jobs. There would be a breaking-in period, but then employees would get to know the technology and see how great it was, and everyone would gradually embrace the new normal. Executives brandish stats showing that automation didn't lead to layoffs, just higher productivity. America would be competitive again. Why should anyone be afraid? Workers might have been initially scared that they would be made obsolete. But the animating anxiety concerned the experience of the work itself, and how effectively the gospel of productivity blinded its leaders to all other concerns. In a 1980 episode of the McNeil Lehrer Report, the journalist Lewis Silverman questioned a lawyer who'd recently implemented automating technologies at his firm if he'd ever worried about how it had depersonalized the experience of work. "I don't think that's in any way a factor in this type of automation," the lawyer replied. "I think what we will see is that the ability to produce documents more quickly increases and frees us to do other things. We will find that rather than doing as many documents in half the time, and then have half the time to do nothing, we will be producing twice as many documents as we did in the past, and working on twice as many transactions." Productivity, in other words, increases output and potential profits. But it doesn't make the clerk's job easier. It doesn't give them more time to rest or increase their pay. It just sets new standards for the sheer amount of work they should be accomplishing in a given day. The benefits flow in one direction, away from the worker. For a counterargument, Silverman turned to Karen Nussbaum, the head of the National Association of Working Women, the organization of office workers previously known as 9 to 5. She quickly listed off the arguments that automation had made workers feel as if they had less control over their work, less connection with their coworkers, and that the technology was affecting their health. Part of the problem was the machines themselves, she said, but an even bigger issue was the productivity they required. When you're operating at peak efficiency, there's no space for any of the human parts of the job. What's more, automation was normalizing doing more work for less pay. But again, leadership didn't see it that way. Jack Walsh, then director of telecommunications and office services at Avon, explained that some secretaries had felt empowered by the new tech and had even gained additional skills. The company conducted a study that found that 10% of a manager's work could be delegated to a secretary, and that secretary's role was thus enhanced. Nussbaum's reply was cutting. "Technology can enhance the work, but that's not what's happening for the large majority of office workers," she said. "I'd be interested to know whether Mr. Walsh increased the pay of any of those secretaries who are now doing the work of some of those managers." This was and remains the dystopian reality underlying the redesign and automation of the office. Its mandate is never, "You figured out how to do your tasks more efficiently, so now you get to spend less time working." It is always, "You figured out how to do your tasks more efficiently, so now you must do more tasks for the same pay." As workers, we've always been assisted by technologies in some form. Those tools have become more sophisticated with time. But as their users, we remain stubbornly human, and there are limits to the productivity that any body or mind can sustain. In the early 1980s, workers began to brush up against those limits, but were driven into survival mode by the continued volatility of the American economy. It didn't matter if the office sucked, if it made you feel ill, if it made you resent your coworkers. Attempts to reorganize, like those led by Nussbaum and Working Women, ran headfirst into a massive wave of anti-labor sentiment and legislation. It felt as if there were no recourse, no way to push back. And so a whole generation of employees internalized their employer's request for productivity as their own, settled for less pay and less stability, and got back to work. In 1983, three employees at Chiat Day Advertising dreamed up an idea that would become one of the most famous Super Bowl ads of all time. A runner dressed in a tank top bearing a drawing of an Apple Macintosh computer destroys Big Brother and saves humankind from a future of surveillance and conformity. The ad was hailed as a masterpiece and cemented Chiat's place as one of the most influential ad agencies of the late 20th century, crafting campaigns that somehow transform brands as banal as Energizer batteries and the NYNEX white pages into ad campaigns that took up occupancy in your brain and refused to leave. A decade later, the co-founder, Jay Chiat, had a creative revelation, supposedly while skiing at Telluride, that had nothing to do with an ad campaign. It was time, he decided, for an office revolution. He wanted to get rid of not just the cubicles, but personal space altogether, in the hopes of creating a space of creative unrest. In one of the new offices, built in Venice, California, and designed by Frank Gehry, there would be no cubicles, no filing cabinets, no fixed desks. Every employee would check out a PowerBook and a portable phone upon arrival and find a place to work for the day. They could even work at home or at the beach if they chose. Your office could be wherever your mind was. None of this will sound wild to anyone who's visited a startup in the last 10 years, but at the time, Chiat's vision of the first virtual office was just as titillating as all those original plans for the open office. The receptionist's desk was framed by the outline of bright red lips. A picture of a man peeing led the way to the men's room. The floor was covered in a rainbow of hieroglyphs. For meetings, there was a club room, a student union, a romper room, and a series of conference rooms filled with cars rescued from old tilt-a-whirl rides. At first, the Chiat Day offices were celebrated as the work of creative visionary. The Manhattan office, designed by the Italian architect Gaetano Pesce, was hailed by the New York Times as a remarkable work of art. But as with the original open office plan, workers hated it almost immediately. Employees from the time recalled feeling at once rootless and constantly surveilled. Desperate for a place to call their own, many began setting up shop in the conference rooms. In response, Chiat would roam the halls, demanding to know if an individual had worked in the same spot the day before. The company had under-anticipated the plan for the everyday demands of PowerBooks, and the lines to check them out were interminable. With no place to call their own, employees resorted to using the trunks of their cars as filing cabinets. People panicked because they thought they couldn't function, Chiat later admitted. Most of it, I felt, was an overreaction, but we should have been more prepared for it. Chiat sold the company in 1995, and the new owners almost immediately began to soften the most outlandish and unsustainable components of the design. In December 1998, they moved the West Coast offices into a new, equally ballyhooed space in Playa del Rey. The desks were back, and so were the phones, placed in nests and cliff dwellings, divided into neighborhoods, lined with indoor plants. The message of the office, as Wired put it, was stay a while, stay all night. Hell, you can live here. Which makes obvious sense in a business that is fueled by 20-somethings pulling late-nighters. In hindsight, the Chiat Day offices anticipated the hot desk gang offices of the pre-pandemic present. But Chiat had misunderstood how to actually unroot his workers from their desks and incentivize productivity and creativity. It wasn't through art or tilt-a-whirl cars or flashy graphic design. You needed to make them want to be there all the time. Chiat Day was far from the only company eager to construct an office design that aimed to reflect its iconoclastic mission. If your company was creating truly innovative products, it should follow that it's working out of a truly innovative space. Like the Chiat Day Venice campus, these environments were designed as competitive advantages. They'd look cool and attract talent, sure, but the spaces, too, would be generative, a perfect mix of socializing, collaboration, and deep focus. Of course, none of these companies were any less ruthless about the productivity demands on the work, and the nature of work was no less transactional. If anything, organizations actually baked more precarity into workers' lives in pursuit of growth and shareholder value. But there was a highly cost-efficient, low-friction way to distract employees from this fact. Just group them in inviting environments that fit the company's projected cultural values of dynamism and community. The office, in other words, as a city, or better yet, as a campus. Back in the 1970s, Midwestern corporate giants like 3M and Caterpillar had designed sprawling bucolic office parks for their thousands of employees, and early Silicon Valley companies like Xerox famously embraced the campus layout in the 1970s. These early campus environments made economic sense. They allowed companies to abandon costly urban real estate, and their location was easier to sell to prospective employees who planned to make their homes in the suburbs. But as William White, author of The Organization Man, explained, there was a deeper, more subliminal intent to the design, particularly for recent graduates. The locale shifts, the training continues. For at the time that the colleges have been changing their curriculum to suit the corporation has responded by setting up its own campuses and classrooms, he wrote. By now, the two have been so well molded that it's difficult to tell where one leaves off and the other begins. Corporate campuses were not quite fortresses, but they were private, guarded, and intended to be as self-sufficient as possible. And like small liberal arts college campus, their cultures were insular, loyal, and generally easy to control. Their skill at innovation stemmed, at least in part, from the not-so-subtle blurring of work and home life. The corporate campus shaped the organization man, and then the suburbs became, in White's words, communities made in the organization man's image. These workers might not have slept on campus, but the office norms extended far beyond its corporate walls, in social structures built to accommodate and reinforce the rhythms of the devoted worker. The office complexes and campuses of the last 30 years extended this notion even further. They're even more gorgeous and eminently photographable. But they're also expertly designed by cutting-edge architects to be cohesive communities. The goal, not just productivity, but as the architect Clive Wilkinson put it in his 2019 book, The Theater of Work, something far more aspirational and dignified. In these spaces, human work may be finally liberated from drudgery and become inspiring and invigorating. Wilkinson, who designed Google's 500,000-square-foot Googleplex campus in Mountain View, California, says he had his first epiphany about the office in 1995. While reviewing old studies and surveys about worker habits, he came upon a study that measured how office workers spent their time between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. He was immediately struck by just how much unaccounted time workers were spending away from their desks. That is, not in meetings or any other explicit work function. But Wilkinson found it hard to believe that all these workers were taking multi-hour bathroom breaks or simply leaving the office altogether. They were still in the office. They were just hanging out in the hallways, chatting in the foyers, clustering around someone else's desk, as the occupant tells a story. "It blew my mind," he told us, "and it made our team realize that the planning of the office was fundamentally flawed." His realization was straightforward. Office design had long revolved around the placement of desks and offices, with the spaces in between those areas treated as corridors and aisles. But that overemphasis on the desk, as Wilkinson recalled, had worked to the detriment of working life, trapping us in this rigid formality. And so he set out to liberate it, shifting the focus of his designs to work that took place away from the desk. In practice, this meant designing bleachers and nooks in places that were once poorly lit corridors and spacing out desk clusters to incentivize more movement among teams. A kinetic office environment, the idea went, could increase spontaneous encounters, which would then spark creativity. The design also allowed for private areas, many with comfy couches and push ottomans to replicate a family room feel, to do deep work, away from the noisy bullpen of desks. Google's founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, were especially fascinated with this new brand of office. In early meetings, Wilkinson recalls that the pair's ideas for design were heavily influenced by their time at Stanford, where engineers tended to gather in small groups and often flocked to far-flung enclaves of the campus for coding binges and study groups. They wanted to merge the traditional office with the university environment, creating a space that would incentivize both collaborative and self-directed work. Wilkinson thus developed a design whose unifying goal, like that of a college campus, was self-sufficiency. That meant flexible workspaces designed to accommodate constantly shifting teams and new projects. But it also meant abundant green spaces, mini-libraries, social hubs, and tech talk zones, which Wilkinson later described as areas along public routes where almost continuous seminars and knowledge-sharing events would take place. In service of this continued knowledge sharing, the Googleplex was outfitted with a staggering array of amenities. Volleyball courts, valets, organic gardens, tennis courts, and soccer fields dot the campus, which also includes a private park for exclusive Google use. Inside the Googleplex, workers have access to multiple fitness centers and massage rooms, as well as multiple cafes, cafeterias, and self-service kitchens. Unlike traditional company cafeterias, where food items are often gently subsidized, everything at Google is free. In 2011, when the company had around 32,000 employees, the food service budget was estimated at around $72 million per year. Since then, Google's workforce has more than quadrupled. In Wilkinson's recounting, the Googleplex design was meant to allow for all of your basic work-life needs to be met within a contained space. As he saw it then, supporting workers with the generative social environments plus significant perks like meals and wellness services was a means to foster true community and sustained creativity. More important, it was a humane, considerate way for companies to treat employees who are working long hours and building products designed to change the world. Reflecting today, Wilkinson's less sure of that vision. Over the last two decades, his brilliant, innovative designs have rippled through the architecture world, as large-scale tech companies and smaller startups alike have cribbed elements of his team's dynamic workplaces for their spaces. And Wilkinson's increasingly aware of the insidious nature of those same perks. Making the work environment more residential and domestic is, I think, dangerous, he told us in late 2020. It's clever, seductive, and dangerous. It's pandering to employees by saying, we'll give you everything you like, as if this was your home. And the danger is that it blurs the difference between home and office. The danger Wilkinson is describing is, of course, exactly what happened. The new campus design had a profound impact on company culture. Some of that impact was undeniably positive. He created workspaces where people genuinely wanted to be. But that desire becomes a gravitational pull, tethering the worker to the office for longer and longer, and warping previous perceptions of social norms. Imagine this scenario. You're an ambitious engineer, a few years out of school. It's easy to get to the office extra early and stay late into the night because you can always get a gourmet dinner, absolutely free, with little effort on your part. During these meals, you often meet with coworkers. You talk about a lot of things, but you mostly talk about work. To blow off steam, you show up at one of the many company gyms for a game of 3-on-3, or you play frisbee in the company park. When the company brings in an interesting speaker, you attend the lecture. When you're on a code binge, you camp out together in the comfy, free use spaces. When you're done for the day, you grab a beer on campus before riding the company shuttle back to your apartment in San Francisco, chatting with your friends as you catch up on back emails, using the shuttle's Wi-Fi connection. With time, your colleagues become your closest friends, and with even more time, your only friends. It's easier to hang out and have a social life at work, because everyone's just already there. Life feels streamlined, more efficient, even fun. Sometimes you're just goofing off, killing time. Kind of like back in the dorm room in college. Other times, you're working together, like those endless nights back in the library. Sometimes it's a hazy hybrid of both, but it's generative nonetheless. It's the new organization man-style company devotion, only the country clubs moved onto campus. While we didn't work for a big tech company in Silicon Valley, we both experienced shades of this trajectory while working for a media startup in New York City in the middle of the second decade of the 21st century. As early-ish employees, we quickly fell into the perks that drew us to the office longer. A weekly Thursday afternoon bruise, all hands, was capped off by free pizza, and then a collective call-out to the bars. Quickly, our colleagues became our closest friends. It's not lost on us, of course, that these events are how the two of us eventually met. The company culture's gravitational pull meant we started dedicating less time to other friends and fledgling non-work relationships. It was always far easier to transition from the office straight to socializing than somehow planning a meetup halfway across town. We knew all the same people and had all the same conversational shorthand. During happy hours with coworkers, bullshitting could quickly turn into a discussion about a work issue. Were we working? Sure, but none of us would have thought to call it that. We love our old work friends. We've been to their weddings. We're watching their kids grow up. We continue to share our lives with them. Those actual friendships aren't what we regret, and never will be. When we moved away from New York, however, we came to realize how work friendships had functioned as Trojan horses for work to infiltrate and then engulf our lives. These relationships didn't make work-life balance more difficult. Instead, they eclipsed the idea of balance altogether, because work and life had become so thoroughly intertwined that spending most of our waking moments with some extension of our corporation didn't seem remotely odd or problematic. It was just life. Most white-collar workers don't have the privilege of catered daily meals or sun-drenched atriums arrayed with ergonomic seating for impromptu brainstorming sessions. But just because they can't head to the quad for pickup volleyball doesn't mean they're not similarly trapped by the design and tech of the office. Consider, for one moment, the long history of your inbox. Email's road to ruin is, like most technologies, paved with good intentions. In 1971, ARPANET engineer Ray Tomlinson used the now famous at symbol to direct a message to a very small number of super expensive network computers. At the time, it was just a small coding workaround. This was in the early days of answering machines, and there was just no good way to leave a message for someone, especially if they didn't have a secretary or answering service. But leaving a message for a unique user on a computer, maybe that could work. By the time Tomlinson realized the gravity of what he'd done, just over two decades later, email was in the process of being adopted broadly in the workforce. The pitch for workplace adoption was simple. Instead of drowning in a sea of paper, office work could shift to the computer. No more printing or mimeographing by hand or faxing. No more hand delivering. Just push a button and send a message. But instead of dismantling the culture of interoffice memos and correspondence, email simply soaked up all of their formalities, anxieties, and oppressive mundanity, and then made them readily accessible for every moment of the day. The spread of email led to, well, a whole lot of email. So much that it generated a cottage industry of how-to guides and books with titles like The Executive Guide to Email Correspondence and Email, a Write-It-Well Guide. The authors of these books spend hundreds of pages painstakingly outlining templates for every situation, like how to send a Request for Cooperation email. In one book, there's a chapter titled Delicate Situations, which includes templates for emails on reassigning fault, request for special treatment, misplaced document, and refusal to participate. Blueprints for bad habits abound, like this section from the Executive Guide to Email Correspondence. The message, "I'll be on vacation next week," communicates unfavorable news. You're on vacation? Does that mean you're not working? Even when you're taking a well-deserved break, it's a good idea not to brag about it, or even mention it. The problem should be familiar by now. Adopt technology or design for its efficiency or cost savings, and without thinking about its holistic effects on the office and its culture, and you'll end up with an entirely new set of problems. Email might have been direct and fast, but it failed almost immediately to make good on its promise to kill paper in the workplace. In one study from the mid-1990s, researchers found that the introduction of email within an organization led to a 40% average increase in paper consumption. As the cognitive and computer scientists Abigail J. Sellin and Richard H.R. Harper found in The Myth of the Paperless Office, published in 2001, it seems much of the information on the web needs to be printed in order for us to read it and make sense of it. There was still a glut of paper, in other words, and an increasing glut of email. By the early 21st century, it had become such a problem that an engineer at Google named Paul Buchheit attempted to hack together a fix to save the technology from itself. If you could effectively search your inbox, the idea went, you could create an entirely new way of using email. Instead of stressing out over deleting and saving messages, you could save them forever, creating a massive, readily searchable archive of past correspondence. Google called the service, which it debuted in 2004, Gmail, and offered each user a free gigabyte of archive space, a massive amount of storage at the time. Of course, each user paid for this service by allowing Google to backdoor access to their data, but as with so many privacy exchanges, the cost to the individual user seemed, at least in the moment, negligible. Nearly 20 years later, there are roughly 1.5 billion Gmail accounts in the world. Universities and organizations across the globe have adopted the service as their official email application, while its closest competitors, Yahoo and Hotmail, gradually adapted their services to fit the Gmail style. Email has become far less formal, but also more ubiquitous. Because inbox space was essentially limitless, we stopped attempting to control it. Filtering tabs decluttered the inbox, pushed many emails out of view, and lowered open rates for email marketers, resulting in more promotional emails. Google had attempted to fix email, but couldn't save it from being corrupted by our worst impulses and insecurities. In 2014, when the Time journalist Harry McCracken tried to send a message to Buchheit, he got an away message. Buchheit was on an email hiatus. When McCracken finally got a hold of him, Buchheit was unsparing in his critique of what Gmail had facilitated. There's a 24/7 culture where people expect a response. It doesn't matter that it's Saturday at 2 a.m., people think you're responding to email, he said. People have become slaves to email. It's not a technical problem. It can't be solved with a computer algorithm. It's more of a social problem. Instead of confronting the social problem that allowed email to eat the whole of our lives, we sought out ways to wrangle it, control it, zero it, put it in handcuffs. We created productivity tools to manage a productivity tool and found ourselves deeper and deeper in a hole, desperate for the solution that promises to finally allow us to dig ourselves out. In 2012, McKinsey was on the hunt for just such a solution. Something, anything, that could decrease the email burden on workers and boost productivity among its clients. In a report from that year, its analysts found that the average knowledge worker spent 28% of their work week managing email, and nearly 20% looking for internal information, or simply tracking down colleagues who could help with specific tasks. They believed some sort of collaborative chat or social technology had the potential to raise the productivity of knowledge workers by between 20 and 25%. Nearly a decade later, the social technologies the McKinsey report envisioned have integrated themselves in some capacity into all manner of workplaces. There's Microsoft Teams, a hub for collaboration, Facebook Workplace, connect employees with familiar video communication and collaboration tools, Google Hangouts, bring conversations to life, and Slack, a new way to communicate with your team, plus dozens of video conferencing tools, many with chat functions whose use has skyrocketed since the beginning of the pandemic. Zoom, WebEx, BlueJeans, Chime, Skype, and so on. Most offices use some combination of social technologies in their office, but Slack is the paradigm shifter. Back in 2013, it was the first to beguile Silicon Valley with its promise to kill email. The idea was just as simple and elegant as Gmail's had been. Instead of hundreds of employees sorting through their inboxes, hunting down attachments and first drafts and old Google chats, why not connect everyone in one place and allow them to make little play and collaboration areas for themselves? Slack worked. Brainstorming threads that once circulated wildly in inboxes moved into Slack rooms, same for back and forths about ideas and execution. The platform was easy to use, and with custom emojis and integration with Giphy, even intermittently fun. Usage spread organically, often through word of mouth. Employees who had heard about Slack from friends or other companies hounded HR to adopt the technology. Holdouts eventually became converts as the bulk of communication shifted from email chains to chat rooms. One analytics company reported that employees at large companies that had adopted Slack were sending an average of more than 200 Slack messages per week, while power users sent out more than 1,000 messages a day. According to one analysis by Rescue Time, an app that tracks which apps you use and for how long, Slack and other social chat apps did decrease email use. Between 2013 and 2019, the percentage of screen time workers allocated to email went from just under 14% to 10.4%. In reality, they just moved that time to chat apps, whose usage increased from 1% to 5%. The Rescue Time data isn't exactly precise. If you have it installed on your computer, for example, it doesn't measure the time you spend emailing or Slacking from your phone. But this study demonstrates something annoyingly straightforward. Technologies like Slack don't decrease the amount of time users spend communicating online. They just add another, even more demanding and distracting way to do so. Exhaustion and frustration gradually begin to accumulate. I felt increasingly unproductive, highly reactive, and simply overwhelmed by Slack, the programmer Alicia Liu wrote in a 2018 Medium blog post. And the problem got worse the more time I spent using Slack. I kept being constantly pulled in by Slack notifications. These sorts of interruptions come at a significant cost. Researchers have found that even short interruptions of 20 minutes or less increase stress among workers. But because the interruptions feel urgent, and missing out on them feels negligent, workers often struggle to ignore them, at least for long. Instead, we weave them into the workday, creating an ever-expanding tapestry of work, then interruption, interruption, then work. At some point, it begins to feel normal. But that normal feels like crap. If you listen closely, all of the criticisms of Slack start to sound like the latest verse in a decades-long lamentation over new design, new tools, new apps. We're trapped in a determined cycle to find an exact technological fix, neglecting the evidence that, as the cost and difficulty of communication decrease, the number of interactions and time required to process them increase. We ignore the warnings of those who've watched their best-intentioned ideas degrade before their eyes. Recall the words of Gmail's creator. It's not a technical problem. It can't be solved with a computer algorithm. It's more of a social problem. Social problems are hard. They can't be waved away with an idea and a few years of dedicated coding. They require collective action across many fronts, significant stores of insight, patience, and most important, will. A potent mix of dissatisfaction with the way things are, coupled with the vision of how they could, in fact, be different. Back in the early 1980s, Karen Nussbaum saw such a moment for office workers across the United States. After years of mistreatment, discrimination, and dropping wages, many workers were pushed over the edge by automation. Their offices were making them sick. They were worn out, and now their bosses were asking them to do more work for less pay. We understood that we had about a 5 to 10 year period to deal with the impact of automation, Nussbaum told us. It was a major disruption in the structure of work, and there was an opportunity to reach workers during this period when their individual jobs were dramatically changing. But Nussbaum knew that they had to act fast. Once workers had cycled into a new job with the new norms, that same moment of questioning what standards there should be, it would be gone. Nussbaum and the National Association of Working Women had the will and the vision to help organize clerical and office workers. But they ran up against a cultural wall of anti-union sentiment, anti-feminist sentiment, and an overwhelming American boosterism amid the Cold War. The wall is of a slightly different character today, but no less formidable. In countries all over the world, people will say the focus should be on rebuilding the post-COVID economy, on beating out the global competition, on innovating and hacking our way to a new office future. But as the last several thousand words have made clear, there is no one office design, no single technical innovation that can actually fix the social problem of the way we've arranged office work. We'll address some of the ways that you can begin to address that problem in the chapter to come. But for now, here's our best advice on how to peel back the layers of misguided utopianism, misdirection, and distraction that have accumulated around technology and design in your office, and how, in this brief and wild moment of flux, we can begin to imagine and embrace a different way forward. Stop dreaming of the office of the future. It's possible that the secret to breaking a productivity doom loop was discovered in an office somewhere in Copenhagen in the early 1990s. Exactly which office? We don't know. In fact, we don't even know the company's actual name. The researchers who conducted the case study refer to it only as DanTech, short for Danish Tech Company. But DanTech's story, chronicled by Abigail J. Sellin and Richard H.R. Harper in The Myth of the Paperless Office, is unique. Not because of what they make, or the size of their profits, or whom they employ, but because they manage to modernize an office without simply perpetuating all the mistakes and problems of the past. DanTech's story begins in the 1980s. The company was falling behind in its industry and facing an uncertain future, and leadership decided to try something drastic. They would completely change their organizational structure and then start again from scratch. Employees were trained to do two or more jobs so the teams could be broken apart and reconfigured at will. To facilitate the internal reorganization, they moved buildings and physically reorganized the office space, filling it with generic desk clusters so teams could collaborate when necessary and then work separately with ease. They put a strict cap on how much paper any one employee could use or keep in their workspace, instead encouraging workers to rely on an electronic filing stations and early PCs. These changes don't sound revolutionary today, but at the time it was the equivalent of, say, giving all your employees an Oculus headset and telling them to conduct all business henceforth in virtual reality. And not all of them worked out. One of their electronic filing databases was so complicated employees had no real idea how to use it, which meant important documents ended up lost in a digital maze. With time, however, employees found a system that worked for them. They put a handful of workers, already proficient with the system, in charge. It was probably less efficient than training everyone at the company, but more feasible. After roughly 18 months, the company had managed to pull off what most workspaces then believed was unthinkable. They'd gone primarily paperless, becoming one of the early digital offices of the age. For Sellin and Harper, who had been painstakingly studying paper as the primary office technology of the 20th century, Dantech was a rare example of real change. Since the mid-1970s, futurists and business pundits had been predicting the imminent rise of the paperless office. But try as they might, the IBMs and Xeroxes of the world were still using plenty of paper by the 1990s. In the disastrous Shiat redesign in 1993, the sight of a piece of paper would trigger emails chiding workers that they worked in a paperless office, even though much of the creative ad work was still done on storyboards, and contracts with outside companies still needed to be printed out and signed. The office of the future was still very much tethered to the printer. And yet this team of Danes seemed to have stumbled into a paperless future, almost by accident. They did it by thinking about the change in terms of sustainability. As Sellin and Harper explain, Dantech never set a goal to abolish paper use altogether. Instead, the company focused on ways to teach and incentivize employees to think about using paper differently. And with time, they began to use less and less. Promise a paperless office and you set yourself up for disappointment and failure, Sellin and Harper wrote. Promise incremental, realistic changes, and the goals are more likely to be met. People more likely to be satisfied. This story and its lesson, though, are not really about paper or whether a paperless office is necessarily better than an office that does things the old-fashioned way. The Danish office in question is a lesson in how to create change in an organization that might stick. Dantech was playing the long game. The company managed its employees' expectations. It pushed for bold and potentially painful changes, but when they resulted in confusion or negative outcomes, as with the filing system, they were willing to revise and reassess. Last, as Sellin and Harper note, Dantech's overhaul was focused on the real underlying problems. Paper was never actually the problem, but they understood that modernization could be a means to fix the very real structural issues that had left them lagging behind their competitors. Organizations need to look at the combination of people, artifacts, and processes to assess where the problems may lie and how solutions can be implemented, Sellin and Harper explained. They need to look both broadly and deeply at what exists already. In practice, it probably felt pretty boring, or at least far less daring and invigorating than throwing out paper altogether, or issuing a bunch of bold proclamations. But that had been the fatal flaw in the plans of so many designers and innovation specialists. They imagined a future and then designed it entirely from scratch, with no eye to the ways that it would exacerbate existing tensions or fail to address fundamental needs. That's precisely what Shiat Day did, and they ended up with splatter-painted quagmire and people furtively hiding printouts, files, and contracts in their cars. But some companies, like Dantech, conceived of the office of the future by attempting to fully understand the office of the present. In those cases, Sellin and Harper found that the plants rarely looked like implementing conventional digital technologies. The most lasting forms of innovation don't look great on a press release, because they're incremental. Periodically involve pausing or reversing plans, and, at least to outsiders, seem tedious. They're honest about an organization's failings, unprecious about tradition, and compassionate and empathetic in their solutions. We've become so obsessed with our own techno-utopian visions, the open office, the paperless office, the remote office, but have so rarely taken the time to find the right, winding road that will actually make them a reality. That's why the history of the office is essentially one long game of tech and design whack-a-mole. You can deal with one problem, but then a new set of equally stubborn problems pop up in its place. Solve for the real underlying problems, though, the ones that don't sound exciting and innovative, and, like Dantech, you might notice truly innovative fringe benefits. The pandemic has proven that flexible, remote office work is indeed possible at scale. But tech alone cannot make that future sustainable. More efficient tools and greater productivity, the end goal of most of our work tech, is not the solution, because productivity is not the problem. Look around at any pre-pandemic office, or drop into any post-pandemic Slack room, and you'll find that people are not miserable or demoralized because they lack ways to be productive. The problems are deeper, messier, and far more human. If we want an office of the future, and more important, if we actually want it to succeed, We need to stop drafting blueprints for some color-corrected, face-tuned sci-fi fantasy. Instead, we need to confront the unflattering, unsexy, foundational problems of the present and start building sustainably from there. Level the office playing field. The truth about post-pandemic work is that most of us are going back to the office at some point, in some form. Maybe that sentence sparks a bit of joy inside you. Maybe it fills you with dread. But if we were to look at the future from the present, it seems clear that, at least in the short term, many of us will head back to a familiar desk under the hum of fluorescent lights for anywhere between 1 and 5 days a week. Many companies own or lease their office space on long-term contracts, and when the space is there, sitting on the company's expenses, it's likely that management is going to incentivize employees to use it. And after we've been trapped in our homes, hiding from a deadly virus for well over a year, we're starved for social interaction. Many of our former commuting and workplace annoyances now sound like tiny luxuries. Some of us miss our colleagues. Others are just sick of their homes and apartments, and yes, even their partners and kids. The only question is, how? It's a problem that's filled Jennifer Christie's days for more than a year now. As Twitter's chief human resources officer, she's one of the architects of the company's work strategy, which has meant divining a way forward for more than 6,000 employees post-COVID. In May 2020, Twitter announced plans to make full-time remote work permanent for any employees who wanted it. The news promoted a flood of opinion pieces, all suggesting in various formats that this might be the moment that work-from-home revolution begins in earnest. Which explains why a lot of people are watching Christie and the company's plan closely. Twitter, along with a handful of other organizations, feel like bellwethers. The pressure to succeed or quickly fail and tell everyone to go back to the way things were is high. When we spoke to Christie in early 2021, she told us what every manager and consultant we've spoken with knows to be true. Remote work isn't the hard part. Neither, ultimately, is in-person work. It's the hybrid, flexible schedule that's tricky. And again, the fundamental problem with a hybrid schedule is inadvertently creating a new hierarchy based around physical face time. Of course, proximity issues inside offices are not new. Pre-COVID, everything from desk layout to who gets invited to meetings with the boss can determine who's seen as a valued hard worker and who gets overlooked, or who has their contributions taken for granted. Hybrid work threatens to deepen those divides. Single parents, workers with elderly family members, disabled employees, and those who simply don't want to live in proximity to the office risk being overshadowed by those who come in every day. And even if a manager is careful, a recency and proximity bias might emerge. Ambitious, competitive employees will sacrifice remote flexibility and work relentlessly in person, while remote employees, motivated by the anxiety of not seeming productive, will live in fear of managers and compensate with overwork. Both sides end up driving the other to misery. This is the nightmare scenario for Christie and the focus of much of Twitter's early hybrid work planning. The solution? Destroy the FOMO and level the playing field by making the office less appealing. You need to eliminate the idea that you'll miss out if you're not in the office, she told us, which is why they're attempting to figure out ways to actively disincentivize people from coming back to the office full time. For a long time, we've rallied around the office perks and keeping people around and in the building, she said. Tech companies have celebrated and mastered it. Come to the office and you get fed, you get cared for. That whole well-fed, well-cared-for campus philosophy has to change, Christie said, and it starts with the way the office is arranged and the expectations for people within those spaces. At Twitter, everyone inside the conference room will be asked to have an open laptop and dial into the meeting to make sure that remote participants can see all faces clearly and hear those who, in a different configuration, might have traditionally been far away from the conference microphone. The company plans to get rid of team spaces and offices and will transition fully to hot desking, aka unassigned desks, with some spaces reserved for deep work and others for busier, more social areas. One of the main goals is ensuring that absences aren't felt. If desks were assigned and team-based, the privileges of proximity would naturally flow down to those able and willing to come into the office on a more regular basis. Which isn't to say that in-person group work won't happen. Twitter is simply incentivizing teams to coordinate when they come in, aiming to create episodic moments of collaborative work. "We don't want our office to be remote first or office first," Christie continued. "We want to level the field, and that means we have to stop doing things in the office that we do well, like the current way we do food service. We're trying to disincentivize some parts of that experience that lull you into the office. We're trying to take away some of that ease." For many managers and executives, the idea of introducing friction into the functional workplace might sound counterintuitive or even straight up foolish. But at least in its earliest stages, Twitter seems to understand that merely layering remote work on top of the current workforce is paving a path to dysfunction. "You have to commit your entire culture to this change," Christie said. "You cannot do it half-assed." Achieving an equitable balance between in-office and remote employees is going to be fraught, even for the most thoughtful companies. You can easily imagine those who spend more time in the office resenting a workplace that privileges remote workers, and employees working from home will resent coworkers with easier access to superiors. That tension is the reason that Dropbox, a cloud computing company in San Francisco, decided back in October 2020 to transform itself into a virtual-first organization. Early in the pandemic, Melanie Collins, Dropbox's chief people officer, helped gather internal data on the company's productivity patterns. Like many software companies, Dropbox's product lifecycle was undisturbed by the remote shift. Engineers were exceeding performance goals, and internal metrics and surveys showed that workers wanted the changes to stick. The vast majority of employees even expressed a desire for more flexible work schedules and locations. But instead of offering remote work as a permanent option, Dropbox chose a more drastic route. The company would shift all individual work to remote, with options for teams to come together and collaborate episodically as necessary. To that end, the company would redesign and build a new style of office, dubbed Studios, in four cities where the company previously had an official office. In other cities with clusters of Dropbox employees, the company would provide passes to co-working spaces. When we spoke in April 2021, Collins told us that Dropbox was designing the spaces with meetings and other team-building activities in mind. Employees wouldn't have desks assigned to them or any other spaces that would encourage them to camp out and establish unofficial office space. They're meant to facilitate collaboration, not function as shadow offices. But all of that is subject to change. "The only way to design a collaborative space is to do tons of surveying," Collins told us. "We have a hypothesis informing the design, but we'll learn a lot more when people get into them. We already know that sales and engineering have different needs, but we'll need to ask, how are people using the space? What's the utilization like? Are 10-person rooms fully booked, or is just one person hanging out in it? Are rooms for team bonding used that way, or are they taking on a different role? And we'll make changes accordingly." Collins stressed that no company, Dropbox included, knows what these plans will look like in 2 to 3 years. As the company moves forward, it wants to be iterative, flexible, and willing to say, "This isn't working," until they figure out the right configuration. Within that flexibility, there's one certainty. They're not going back to a traditional 9-to-5 workday. For many workers, that will mean a set of on hours that overlap with all U.S. time zones, with the freedom to set their own schedule outside those times. Not all employees are going to work well with that sort of transformation, and Dropbox realizes that much. "Our shift to virtual first is a deliberate shift away from the office perks and entitlements to work-life balance," Collins told us. "And we know some employees didn't choose this when they joined. We know and expect there'll be some turnover while we build for the future." And even though some employees may opt to leave, Dropbox envisions long-term gains in the expansion of their potential hiring pool and their ability to attract employees who want flexible work patterns. As Collins put it, "We're taking some of the pain that comes with transformation in stride." Both Dropbox and Twitter seem to understand that they're not going to get everything right immediately. Not even close. In our conversation, Christie outlined the numerous unsexy issues that a global company like Twitter is anticipating. Dealing with work authorization forms, immigration, visas, corporate tax structures, security and IT issues, business licenses, payroll setups, tax assessments, and more. "If you think you can just auto-flip a switch and all of this just happens, it's not going to work," she said. "You can't recreate the office remotely or you're just going to suffocate your employees. In other words, everything has to be intentional. That intentionality especially applies to groups that are usually left out of the design process. For leaders in the disability community, the remote work shift can feel fraught. Flexible work, an accommodation that people with disabilities have been asking for and denied for decades, is more available than ever before. But there's also a very real concern that the ability to work from home could end up making actual office spaces less inclusive. What I don't want to see is all employees who have disabilities relegated to working from home because newly designed spaces are even less accessible than they are now, Maria Town, the president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, told us. It's far too easy to imagine companies offering hybrid work, but treating their disabled workers as fixed remote employees, thereby reinforcing the segregation of disabled people in the workforce. If we get into this world where we have fewer centralized offices, it literally means that employees are exposed to fewer people that are different than them, Town said. There's a lot of cultural value in having people show up at work and be visibly disabled. She used herself as an example. Town says her cerebral palsy is most visible when she's moving around in a space. During the pandemic, my disability has been completely erased. All you see is my head in a little Zoom box. Town stressed to us that creating opportunities for visibility and community engagement among disabled employees is crucial and will require delicately balancing those concerns with the necessity to make more jobs available for telework and those who need it. In other words, accessibility needs to be embedded into every technology and space designed for remote-first or hybrid work environments. To do so, organizations will need to involve different types of workers in the process of drafting their remote and flexible strategies, not just those in the HR and the C-suite. That's because physical spaces, at least in the short term, aren't going anywhere. Dror Poleg is the co-chair of the Urban Land Institute's Tech and Innovation Council, and years before the pandemic hit, he was collecting data about the changing needs of employees and employers for his 2019 book, Rethinking Real Estate. Poleg believes there have been indications that the office market was headed for a crisis for some time. The benefits of the office had ceased to outweigh the negatives. Office costs were skyrocketing, and offices did little to assist perceived or actual productivity. Which means that even before the pandemic, companies were looking for solutions to the problem of their real estate holdings. The sudden onset of work from home simply accelerated that desire. Still, Poleg is bullish that office spaces will continue to exist in some form, but their location and utility will shift dramatically. Most office activity will not move to homes or to the cloud, he wrote in the New York Times. Instead, it is likely to be redistributed within and between cities, with a variety of new employment areas popping up and saving many people the trouble of simultaneous commuting to a central business district. What will that look like in practice? Co-working spaces, but also smaller satellite offices, oriented around what office workers actually need from the office, depending on their field. Large-scale printing and shipping capabilities, collaborative space, private yet public space to meet with clients, or a recording studio for podcasts or YouTube videos. There's no easy fix, just the hard, continuous work of stripping out what's broken and designing the future based on the present. But if you shy from that work, you will likely find yourself outmatched by those who don't. We didn't go down this path because of COVID, Christy, Twitter's head HR officer says. We went down it because the world was already shifting pre-COVID, and we thought, we have to get on the bandwagon or we won't attract and retain talent. Companies that think this too shall pass and will go back to being an office company are sorely mistaken. If you miss this window, you won't be a great company for long. What do you actually miss? As of this writing, the last time one of us was in a physical office space was December 20th, 2019. As many of you have likely found, this sort of distance has afforded some perspective. When you show up someplace each day, you think about it logistically. An office isn't an idea. It's a space to be navigated in the moment. But with time, maybe you've been asking yourself deeper questions about the place where you spent your days. What is the point of being present in the office 40 hours a week? Why did we all sit in cubes? Why were we crammed into an open pen? Did the office make me more productive or less? All of those questions are subsets of a larger interrogation. What is an office, really? That might sound like a philosophy 101 bong rip sort of a question, but the answer matters. Is it the people? The space itself? The proximity? All of the above? None of it? We've dedicated a lot of time here to warning against techno-utopian thinking. But at this moment, it's also worth asking if the office, or some meaningful experience of it, can be reproduced without the commute and the whole act of being in a physical space. And if so, should we seek it out? The virtual office is hard to love. What makes an office feel alive, the murmur of voices, the movement, the myriad social interactions, large and very small, that's what so many of us miss. The virtual office, manifested in some sort of a chat platform, is usually a woefully inadequate replacement, no matter how many breakout and special interest rooms you can create. But attempts to push this idea further, usually through some sort of Sim-style video game approach, complete with customizable avatars, feel immediately corny, uncanny, or straight-up dystopian. It feels as if we should give up on trying to recreate an actual approximation of the office and let remote work be remote. At least that's what we thought up until we spoke to Dayton Mills. We first met Mills at his office. Shortly before, we bumped into each other just outside, on a recently mowed lawn with appropriately manicured shrubbery. We exchanged pleasantries, and then he welcomed us inside a modern, wood-floored room. As startup offices go, Mills's was spartanly outfitted, but still had the usual startup design suspects. There were a smattering of succulents on the table, a mess of beanbag chairs, and even an unused pool table in the corner. He motioned for us to sit down on a gray couch with a flashlight that shot out a purple beam of light. We did as we were told. In the office, Mills is no normal founder. He's a floating, purple blob with a wry smile. Or at least that's what he looks like, according to his avatar. In reality, Mills is a 19-year-old, with big rectangular glasses and a mop of curly brown hair and kind, human eyes. A fact we learned when he turned his webcam on for a few minutes into the chat. His office wasn't real, or rather, it wasn't physically real. But it's still the full-time workplace for his company, Branch. Branch markets itself as a platform for spatial conversations, and combines the team chat elements of a platform like Slack with video and a 2D Super Nintendo aesthetic. When you log into an office, you become a colorful, smiley-faced blob. You have a bird's-eye view of the entire office and can guide your avatar around the different rooms, all of which are customizable. There are conference rooms, cafeterias, private offices, breakout rooms, game rooms, and even the dreaded copier mailroom makes an appearance. You can toggle your webcam on or off as you please. Once it's on, your face will appear in a little circular frame at the top of the screen, along with anyone who's in earshot. It feels a bit like corporate Pokemon, or an early version of Zelda, if the purpose of the game were to survive a conference call. The idea for Branch dates back to 2019, when Mills was working for his father-in-law's company. Because he was good with computers, he was tasked with modernizing the organization's sales team, which was made up of dozens of remote workers across the country. Their process was arcane, still heavily reliant on written invoices, fax machines, and printouts. When Mills introduced them to Slack, the team was stunned. Many of the employees hadn't seen or spoken to each other in half a decade. Quickly, they realized they'd been doubling up on work and chasing the same leads and talking past each other for years. Many confessed that they'd spent years feeling isolated and deeply disconnected. Slack helped. But the feeling of proximity was still missing. Mills knew exactly what they meant and how to give it to them. Growing up in a small, rural town in Missouri, he always felt far more comfortable in Minecraft than he did in school. In middle school, he found himself spending more of his life online than off of it. He'd wake up, get on Skype, scroll through his list of friends, and chat all day. Half the time, we weren't even playing the game, he told us. We were just running around and talking and sharing our lives with each other. The connection was real. Some of my closest, longest friends I've never even met in person. He'd been spontaneously cultivating social relationships in digital spaces his entire life. Why not replicate that in the workplace? Sitting in Mills' office, staring at his fake blob as his real voice told us this story, we were skeptical. Then he took us on a tour of the office. Branch's most interesting feature is proximity-based audio, something he cribbed from the popular online environments, like the survival game Rust. When one avatar gets within a certain radius of another, you begin to hear their voice as a soft whisper. As you get closer, the volume gets louder, much like, well, real life. It's easy to dismiss this effect as a gimmick, but the effect is curiously disarming, maybe even a bit profound. Following Mills towards the cafeteria, we heard the faint murmur of voices that, as we entered the room, grew louder. We had stumbled upon a group of Branch employees chatting after a lunch meeting. This wasn't a demo for our amusement. It was the actual Branch employees doing what they do, hanging out in the platform all day while working, meeting, and shooting the shit. When Mills let us pass them, one blob said hello, while the rest kept talking. As we walked away, their voices grew quieter. It was the closest thing to an authentic, mundane office interaction we'd had in 12 months. Branch has the potential to replicate some of the spontaneity of the office, especially the casual quick pop-in that's been replaced with an endless parade of Zoom calls and calendar invites. It's not that the Zoom meeting needs to be an email. Instead, it really needs to be a quick knock and a friendly, "Hey, do you have like 5 seconds? It's the kind of distinctly human interaction that physical offices facilitate, and that not even the glowing red dot of a Slack or Teams message can replicate. Dysfunctional management can't be gamed away using some cute blob avatars, and a toxic culture of overwork might only be exacerbated by an app that incentivizes people to be present, even in the background. If abused, a tool like Branch could transfer the oppressive, consuming nature of the office and the pressure to always be performing engagement with your job, something we already find ourselves doing on Slack. But it's also easy to see the ways in which a virtual world could foster a more inclusive culture. For a self-described introvert like Mills, virtual workplaces allow him to be a company leader without the performance anxiety. "Nobody cares what I look like. Nobody is staring at me," Mills said. "You're more in control of how you present to the world. You can be who you want to be." And then there's the logging out. Many Branch employees spend long hours on the platform, but when they leave it, they've clearly signaled that their day is over. You can reach them when they log back on. Guardrails, ready made. Maybe you're rolling your eyes at this. A virtual office could be a cute, quirky experiment, but gamifying your work life might feel like a bridge too far. Besides, the last thing you want is even more time with your face glued to a screen. All of those objections make sense, but there's plenty of evidence to suggest that time in the physical office is dominated by sedentary time at one's desk, looking at screens. Emails don't magically stop when everyone congregates in an office, and neither do Slack messages. In fact, a great deal of our human presence in the office has been disrupted by the convenience of messaging tools that are text-based. Branch, which is mostly voice-based, offers something arguably more intimate and closer to the feeling of human presence than a vibration, a pinging noise, and a string of text. Branch probably won't decrease the workplace interruptions and frenetic task switching that plagues our days, but it might change the tenor. Would workers butt in less if they had to speak their request? Would coworkers be less anxious if their digital interactions were received through a friendly voice and video-based medium? We don't yet have definitive answers to these questions, but tools like Branch encourage us to ask them. To be clear, there's no quick technological fix to what ails our workplace. What works best for Mills and his team of young, extremely online employees likely won't work for Linda or Mark in accounting at a regional auto parts company. What Branch does best, however, is clarify what the office actually means to you. Because what a lot of us actually miss about the office, apart from not being in our claustrophobic homes, isn't anything all that practical. You might miss what tech executive and essayist Paul Ford calls its secret essential geography, knowing the best place to cry or find privacy or use the bathroom. But what you really miss is a feeling. In some offices, that feeling is playfulness. In others, it's siloed concentration. For Mills, it's an empathetic, ambient presence. You can create connection just by being present, even if you're not saying anything, he told us. People know if they do talk, somebody's there to listen. Whether or not it's a long-term fit, the insights from experimenting with something like Branch may be worth the price of the software license. What feeling do you want to build on as you build a hybrid future? And what traditions and practices can be left behind? Office tech works best when it illuminates and streamlines what's essential. It works worst and feels most exhausting when it layers another app, another password, and an endless number of notifications onto that essential element. You lose sight of your coworkers and your organizational goals, but you also lose sight of your own habits and what makes work feel good or comfortable or generative. As we rebuild the workforce towards a hybrid future, we have to keep asking ourselves not just what we need to jettison about the way we used to work, but also what's worth saving and what those spaces meant to us. Maybe you, too, need some quality time as a blob to figure that out. Stop LARPing. Do you ever find yourself sending an email at an ungodly hour that could easily wait until morning? Do you reply to a group thread on your company chat client with a bland observation or a question that you already know the answer to? Have you ever written the words, "just checking in," while on vacation? If you haven't, you're more disciplined than we are. But most of you will recognize the slightly desperate act of performative work. You hate that you do it, but you don't know how to stop it. It's a form of LARPing, live-action role-playing, your job. And it increases in direct proportion to the amount of anxiety you feel about your performance, your place in the organization, and your relationship with your manager. It's also a massive, massive time suck. The writer John Herman first coined the term LARPing your job in 2015, in the wake of the wide-scale Slack adoption across tech and media. Slack is where people make jokes and register their presence, he wrote. It is where stories and editing and administrating are discussed as much for self-justification as for the completion of actual goals. Of course, before office communications went online, people registered their presence through actual presence. But Slack, like email before it, accelerated both the perceived demand and the ability to do so. The less tangible the work you do, the more need there is to LARP it. The more sudden a shift in your work situation, the more you LARP. Mass LARPing is a symptom of organizational culture in disarray, where expectations are opaque, productivity is paramount, and guardrails are non-existent. Naturally, it exploded during the pandemic and has the potential to metastasize even more as we move towards a flexible work future. LARPing is a virulent pathogen, but there is an antidote. It's just trust, cultivating it, communicating it, propagating more of it. When you don't feel as though your manager trusts you, or, more specifically, how to make use of your time, you feel the need to underline just how much of it you're dedicating to work. You update, you check in, you sneak in casual mentions of how late you worked on something. Maybe your manager actually does trust you, but is just incredibly bad at communicating it. Maybe they never told you to update this way, but never told you to stop either. What matters is that the distrust hangs in the virtual air, goading you to spend more time evidencing your work than actually working. The wild thing about LARPing is that it doesn't just waste your own time. It somehow also wastes everyone's. A flare sent into the air to show that you're working incites others to send up their flares too. One email becomes 5 responses. One Slack update becomes a half-hour conversation. One project, submitted on a Saturday afternoon, creates the compulsion for others to spend their time similarly. Microsoft found that between February 2020 and February 2021, the average Teams user was sending 45% more chats after hours, and 50% of Teams users responded to chats within 5 minutes or less. More and more, we find ourselves in a funhouse mirror of performance anxiety that distorts our understanding of what work even is. It's difficult to engender the sort of robust, enduring trust that can keep those sorts of anxieties at bay. But one of the companies that has managed to do so has a lesson for the aspirationally flexible office. That company is GitLab, a software platform that helps web developers build and share open source code. If you've read about remote work before, chances are you've seen it mentioned as an example. That's because, even pre-pandemic, it had built its company on the premise of truly reimagining work. It doesn't have any offices, and its employees live everywhere, across many time zones. It's fully distributed, fully remote, and fully asynchronous, and it embraces a radical form of transparency. Truly asynchronous work can look intense, but resist the urge to dismiss it entirely. It looks different because it works differently. Because employees are working at different hours in all parts of the world, the company relies on meticulous documentation. Employees take extensive notes on calls, meetings, memos, brainstorming sessions, you name it. Almost all of it, including many of the company's internal deliberations and operations, is posted publicly. In practice, that means someone outside the company can get an idea of how its employees are building the product they might ultimately buy. Internally, it means that an employee in the marketing department can go into GitLab's system and follow what the legal, comms, finance, and engineering teams are doing. They read the team's notes, monitor their objectives and reports, and follow along with their colleagues as they work. Employees are also encouraged to create detailed README pages, which include a full description of what their job is and how they do it, and a personal About Me section. From there, the README can get very granular. Darren Murph, GitLab's head of remote, has README sections like how you can help me, my working style, what I assume about others, what I want to learn, communicating with me, and work from home office setup. The responses are thoughtful and friendly. They aren't demands or even instructions, but they offer a guide to collaboration. GitLab's approach to documentation might sound exhausting, and many employees might never engage with most of the notes from a meeting or a given colleague's README. It would probably take a full day to read the entirety of GitLab CEO Sid Sijbrandij's page, follow the links, and watch all the videos. Some of the language feels stilted, like Sijbrandij's README section titled, "Please chat me," the subject line of emails. There's not a ton of room for improvisation, but that's purposeful. GitLab's process isn't jazz. It's a meticulously composed symphony. What does that mean in practice? Accountability. Ability to work whenever. The removal of all pressure to sit in on a meeting in which you have a tangential role, because the meeting is always recorded. Transparency enhances belonging, Murph told us when we spoke, and it is vital in an office-less company. Even if people don't use the documentation or follow what other colleagues are doing, just seeing it creates an innate sense of belonging. There's a trust that's forged because you can see what everyone is doing. Most companies work exactly opposite of that, intentionally. They want it fully siloed because they're afraid of too much feedback. But it's not the feedback you should be afraid of. It's alienating teams. Murph is arguably the most visible remote work advocate in the country. He's also, at least as far as he knows, the first person to hold the title head of remote work for a larger company. And he's quick to tell you that a remote work revolution will change the world. But he's also a realist. Yes, READMEs and documentation are a more inclusive, more respectful way to organize a workplace. They're also, he argues, better business. If somebody is telling you when they'll be most receptive to your offer or idea, what they're doing is giving you advice that makes you better at your job, he told us. So many of us don't communicate, and we end up ultimately failing because of it. We waste so much of our own time talking to people when they can't hear us. Even if you don't have an altruistic bone in your body, it's a better, more efficient way to do business. The office-less, totally asynchronous model of GitLab will likely seem too intense for most employers. But Murph thinks that those who adapt to a hybrid system, with some office time, should adopt those remote-first ideology that guides GitLab's processes. In practice, that means designing all policies to benefit employees outside the office, with the secondary focus on co-located workers. His reasoning? Most remote-first policies actually work great in the office, but it doesn't work the same way in the other direction. Office-first policies tend to alienate and exclude and decrease communication when applied to remote workers. Remote-first functions great during a crisis, the pandemic being just one example, Murph explained. Remote-first is building a business around being flexible, versus building a business around a rigid space that's locked in place. At Ultranauts, an engineering firm that's been fully remote since its founding in 2013, all meetings, including those among the leadership team, are recorded, transcribed, and made available to the entire company. Resulting decisions are announced on Slack, along with the reasoning behind them. There are no unwritten rules. All of this transparency and accessibility is with a purpose. The company's co-founders worked to craft a transparent, accessible workplace where cognitively diverse teams could flourish. And 75% of their employees are on the autism spectrum. It's yet another example of the benefits of universal design. If you create an environment where clarity and explicitness are paramount, everyone benefits. At Slack, employees use a one-pager system, which includes the time of day that they are most likely to be responsive, plus additional information about how they work best. Like GitLab's readmes, a colleague can scan someone's one-pager before an interaction and quickly ascertain the best way to deliver a piece of information or the most optimal time to reach them. All of this might seem like a bunch of extra work just to have a conversation, but multiple Slack employees told us that reading a colleague's one-pager is considered an act of respect, with the added bonus of saving everyone time. If you take a moment to recognize a fellow employee as a complex person, and not just the other end of an email transaction, your communication will just be better. Transparency and trust mean less bullshit posturing and LARPing, which means less overall anxiety and situational stress. This was true before the shift to a more flexible work environment, but it'll be even more true moving forward. You can liberate employees to spend their time doing better work, or you can implicitly encourage them to spend their days play-acting at busyness. Which sounds better for business? Resist the urge to screw it all up with surveillance. There's a theme that runs through many of the efforts to redesign remote work. It takes time, effort, and money. And not just time, effort, and money directed at consultants to tell you what to do. Whether it involves reconceptualizing a physical space, interrogating the unspoken norms in the office, or establishing actual guardrails around digital technologies, evangelists for flexible work all stress that the way forward requires approaching our jobs with more humanity and trust. And there's little about that process that's quick or efficient. Many employers will attempt to ignore these best practices. The most short-sighted will resist change completely, forcing employees back into the office full-time. But many others, perhaps feeling the competitive pressure, will begrudgingly allow for some remote or hybrid work. They will likely frame flexibility, much as they have before, as a benevolent corporate perk, or, worse yet, an opportunity only available to those who've earned the privilege, suggesting that it could be revoked at any time. These organizations will not re-examine their offices or their management practices. They won't interrogate who benefits from existing structures because they're pleased with who benefits from existing structures. They will view hybrid work as an annoyance to be tolerated or an incentive to be lorded over workers to keep them productive. And to ensure that their newly liberated employees are on their best behavior, they will take the easiest, laziest way out. Surveillance technology runs through the history of work. Blue-collar workers have long had their movements meticulously cataloged, with time cards and overseeing floor managers, and the spread of personal work computers offered employers a direct yet largely invisible conduit to access and analyze employee behavior. More recently, large tech and logistics companies have introduced extensive tracking systems to surveil employees, cross-country truckers, fast food workers, data entry specialists, call center employees. Everyone gets their own noxious brand of surveillance. In the fulfillment centers where Amazon's orders are processed, packaged, and shipped, warehouse workers' every move is recorded and cataloged to track the rates of each individual associate's productivity. The constant pressure has led workers to file complaints with the National Labor Relations Board, alleging strenuous and dangerous working conditions. The monitoring, the workers argue, has led to ruthless terminations where automated systems calculate worker scores like time off task and trigger firings without human input for offenses with robotic titles like productivity and productivity_trend. There's often a sense among white-collar workers that these sorts of blunt surveillance tools can't or won't be used on them. Surveillance is for workers in Amazon warehouses, in other words, not the engineers making more than $150,000 a year. But surveillance has been creeping into offices for years, starting with clerical and secretarial workers, the vast majority of whom were women. Because their work was easier to quantify, it was easier to review, grade, and, if found lacking, use as grounds for dismissal. These office jobs became more unstable then, not because the work was any less essential, but because it was easier to surveil. As workplaces' business went more fully online over the course of the 1990s and the first decade of the 21st century, surveillance began to expand outside the traditional clerical realm. By 2008, Forrester found that more than one-third of companies with over 1,000 employees had staff reading employees' email, and more than 27 million employees were monitored online. Today, surveillance is even more widespread among knowledge workers and far more granular. Companies like Humanize, a workplace analytics organization, use employee ID badges to categorize what workers are doing in the office. According to a 2014 report by Data and Society, the company's insights track who is talking to whom, for how long, and with what tone of voice, how quickly they speak, or when they interrupt, etc., to try to identify what makes for a good team. Another product, called SureView, made by the defense contractor Raytheon, relentlessly tracks employee movements across company devices, browsing histories, every keystroke, the contents of emails, and scans the contents of any file uploaded and downloaded to a USB stick on the company computer. SureView's purpose is to protect companies against corporate espionage or outside security threats, but the software is readily exploitable by vindictive or imperious managers. The more you know about an employee's actions, the more control you have over those actions, and the easier it is to make a case for dismissal. Some employee monitoring software, dubbed tattleware and bossware by privacy advocates, is actually marketed with an eye toward worker welfare. Sure, the software may be invasive, but as the companies behind these programs argue, the insights might actually make work better. An MIT study of Bank of America call center employees found that productivity actually rose when workers were given more time for social interaction, which led to the bank implementing a 15-minute coffee break. Other companies argued that monitoring tools make it easier to identify and elevate productive workers who may have otherwise flown under the radar, and that other forms of surveillance can be used to assist human resources complaints or workplace harassment allegations. All of this sounds okay, or at least potentially helpful, in theory. But the dark side of this form of surveillance consistently outweighs the benefits. In the spring of 2020, as lockdowns forced knowledge workers to labor at home, the New York Times reporter Adam Citariano downloaded a software program called Hubstaff. The program, currently used by more than 13,000 remote businesses, markets itself as the all-in-one work time tracker for managing field or remote teams. His website is bathed in cheery blues and whites, paired with photos of a diverse set of happily tracked employees. It looks like a productivity app, not a surveillance device. It's simple psychology, the site declares. When your team tracks time with Hubstaff, everyone is more aware of how they're spending each minute of their day. After Citariano put Hubstaff on his computer, it began taking hundreds of screenshots of the websites he visited, the emails he wrote, plus any other activities, personal or private. It then tallied up his time in a detailed report, with each 10-minute segment of work categorized down to the percentage of time spent typing or moving the mouse. Each day, it churned out a productivity score, ranking him on a scale of 0 to 100, and sent it to his manager. But Hubstaff's dashboard didn't really understand the kind of work that Citariano did. Phone calls, a crucial part of the reporter's job, were not logged as time working by the platform. Neither was reading online, yet another vital component of the job. Hubstaff's monitoring was so focused on a small and rigid set of tasks and skills that were hardly an accurate judge of productivity. And so Citariano's score was almost always perilously low. One day he worked close to 14 hours, only to register a score of 22. And even though Citariano knew the software was inaccurate, he found himself working more to try to appease it. A lot of his work was of the performative variety, leaving work documents open on the screen so Hubstaff would screenshot them. Instead of increasing his productivity, it made him LARP his job more than he ever had before. Companies like Hubstaff argue that workplace tracking actually gives employees peace of mind, even freedom. This is a two-way street, the company's support webpage for managers reads. If your employees run Hubstaff's time-tracking software while they work, it means you can relax a little more. You won't need to worry about finding out exactly when they are working or where they are working from. Here, Hubstaff frames data harvesting as a way to establish better communication. After all, the problem, according to the support page, is that managing employees, invoicing clients, and paying employees are wasting too much of your time. But effective communication cannot be made effortless, no matter the promises of the company's marketing materials. Good management doesn't scale easily because good communication isn't always efficient. It's often emotional and vulnerable, and it certainly isn't driven by algorithms and big data. Good management is ultimately built on trust, the very kind that surveillance undermines at every turn. We get why a product like Hubstaff is attractive. It promises managerial peace of mind and increased productivity. But most workers don't actually need productivity boosts. In September 2020, Mercer, an HR consulting firm, performed a study of 800 employers across the United States. 94% reported that productivity levels were the same or higher than before the pandemic. What companies need is trust and reimagined management skills, which are far more amorphous, difficult to cultivate, and even more difficult to measure. No wonder they're grasping for a technological shortcut. If companies are worried about sustained productivity, not just the "I'm worried about my job and we're in the middle of a pandemic" variety, then trust is essential. The behavioral psychologist David DeCramer argues that companies fail to see the role or value of trust precisely because its effects are often indirect. Trust means information is communicated more openly, people are more willing to help one another, and willing to test ideas, even if these may ultimately fail. With time, trust leads to more experimentation, more creativity, higher worker satisfaction, the building blocks of quality work. Monitoring software seeks to eliminate risk and uncertainty in the workplace, but fostering a culture of trust actually requires a modicum of risk and uncertainty. Ideally, both are distributed across the workplace. Managers trust the people they manage, and those people, in turn, trust that their managers have their best interests at heart. Each party has to have faith in the other, which means all parties have to feel comfortable with a baseline of vulnerability. But products like Hubstaff disrupt that balance. They render one party vulnerable and the other omniscient. That may produce short-term gains in productivity, but the imbalance of trust will chip away at morale and the very foundation of whatever company culture you're trying to build. If we're not vigilant and proactive, these tools will define the new flexible era of work. When the office was forced into individuals' homes at the onset of the pandemic, companies instinctively reached for the crutch of monitoring software. During 2020, one analyst estimated that an additional 20% of U.S. companies purchased monitoring software for their employees during the pandemic, meaning that roughly 30% of companies are evaluating remote work via some kind of productivity monitoring tool. With this very real fear in mind, we got in touch with Shoshana Zuboff. Since watching the pulp mill workers struggle with the automated door 33 years ago, Zuboff has dedicated her research to thinking about the ways in which our use of technology constantly undermines our best intentions, most famously in her 2019 book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And she's pessimistic about the way that companies are already approaching remote work. "I see these cycles repeated over and over," Zuboff told us. "I've been confronting the same issue, saying the same thing for 42 years, and it's crazy how much the underlying power dynamics remain intact." She believes workers and students will continue to be treated as captive populations, on which new technologies of control can be tested, with little consequence, before migrating to the population at large. And she fears remote work will be the death knell for personal privacy, destroying the final flimsy barriers keeping corporate surveillance out of our homes. "As invasive as limitless worker surveillance has been historically," she said, "there's still a moment when you can get up and leave the damn office." The fight Zuboff has spent the last four decades describing between humans and encroaching surveillance is not, and has never been, a fair one. "You see this with work, but also with all technology," she said. "We're so emptied out. We become easy targets for this marketing of liberation, and companies exploit that to the max. Crucially, the costs of these tools aren't shared with the employers. They fall on the employees, especially the ones without labor power." As we spoke, Zuboff sketched out the contours of a grim potential future, one that hovers uncomfortably over the very premise of this book. Many of the choices and privileges of a remote, flexible future of work will be enjoyed, as they are now, by a select few with the labor power to negotiate and to bargain for them. An elite group will get to reimagine workdays, workplaces, and company commitment to an equitable, flexible, more humane company culture. The rest will get 12-hour days at home and some pre-installed surveillance software that times your bathroom breaks. Near the end of our conversation, Zuboff gestured to the same feelings of guarded hope that undergirds this book. Despite the deep imbalances of power and the exhaustion many of us feel fighting for dignity in our jobs, in our politics, and in our communities, our moment feels unusually plastic, alive with the potential for change. That is, in part, because many people are deeply angry and more aware of the inequities all around them. But also because the vast technological shifts of the 21st century have culminated in a pandemic that has forced us to reimagine parts of our lives that felt the least flexible. In this moment, we are more motivated to agitate for change than at any time in recent memory. We write this book in the hope that we might make use of this unanticipated window, but we also share Zuboff's ambivalence. Once you're familiar with the history of these tools and the consequences of their implementation, it's all too easy to imagine a future where our best intentions and ideas only reproduce the inequalities of the past. But without imagining and articulating the future we want, and the sustainable ways we can try to get there, we are certain to remain stuck in the patterns of the present. Zuboff sees a potential way forward for technology and for our working lives through politics. Not just new labor contracts and laws that actually account for the ways that work has shifted in the digital age, but new social contracts too, forged through collective actions large and small. Of course, collective action, even just basic civic engagement, requires time and energy. It demands space and attention that is so often devoted to our friends, our families, and especially to our jobs. But what if we had more of that time? At the beginning of this chapter, we argued that it's time to see our productivity and efficiency as a means to an actual end, not just a means to more work. Now, it's time to think about what those ends might look like.